The next case is number 03-1970, Shirley Boyd against Phoenix Funding Corporation et al. Good morning, Mr. Hamilton. Let's give everyone a chance to get settled before we begin. Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Phil Hamilton. I represent the plaintiff. This case should have been remanded from the district court back to the state court. The defendants, shorthand Phoenix, Orr, and North American, had all been served in December of 2000.
Could I ask you a question? I mean, I'm very distressed with the vagueness of the record in this case with respect to, among other things, the removal remand question. And I want to know what documentation there is, for example, in the record of the various assignments from Bank One to RFC.
The record does include copies of these assignments.
Both of them, or just...
Yeah, I believe you will find them in the record.
I've looked, and I found on March 21st, 2003, an affidavit by Mr. Osterman, which shows the documentation with respect to the assignment from North American to Bank One, August 8, 2000, and another only about the Rockwell property assigned from Bank One to RFC, nothing about the Washington property. And there's this allegation that you've made that none of these assignments are recorded anyway.
They're in the record, Your Honor. I mean, it would take me a moment to check the record, but copies of those
We've looked really carefully, but anyway, I'll take...
And that's one of the points that we have raised in our remand is the defendants had the burden of establishing why this case should be removed. They never did furnish fully executed or fully recorded copies of the assignments. We never even knew about the assignments until sometime in like September of 2001, fully 10 months after this case had been pending in state court. What the defendants did was creatively come up with a mechanism to find a way to take a second chance at removing the case. Under the first served defendant rule.
So are you arguing that this is something like a section 1359 problem? You know, kind of. It's not quite 1359, but that's the section, as you know, that addresses collusively arranged federal jurisdiction. It's often used in diversity cases. But it sounds to me like your basic argument is that this assignment happens knowingly to evade the time limits that exist in the removal statute.
In my view, that is correct.
And what kind of evidence do we have to support that?
I have no evidence to support that other than to point out that the defendants have the burden to establish that removal was proper. And clearly, we have Homecomings, which was the servicing company, filing a motion to dismiss on September 28, 2001.
And does it ever say anything in that motion? It never says anything like we're not the right party or anything. That's just a motion to dismiss on the merits.
No, the Homecomings motion was to dismiss based on not a proper defendant under Truth in Lending because they're a servicing company, not the actual one to whom the debt is payable.
Right, yeah, I didn't mean that. I meant something different. But anyway...
In my view, collusion...
They aren't saying that we aren't involved in the loan. They aren't saying the loan has been assigned to somebody. They're making this, I would say, merits argument about the Truth in Lending Act.
Correct.
Yeah.
In my view, to permit the defendants, whether there's collusion or not, to do something like this, opens the door for a defendant to run the course in state law and in state court, determine is this going to be a good forum or a bad forum for us, make an assignment to some entity which may or may not be closely related, putting the plaintiff in the position of having to join in that defendant promptly removes. We've greatly expanded the limited jurisdiction of federal courts in doing so.
Right. I want to distinguish here, though, the assignment context from other contexts in which this first defendant, last defendant issue could come up, because if it had simply turned out that you had discovered that there was another defendant out there that you should have sued, and the statute of limitations wasn't a problem. You could bring them in somehow or another consistently with that, and you then named that defendant. As I read the Supreme Court's decision in Murphy, that defendant would have the 30-day period in which to decide whether it wanted to exercise its right to remove. It would be very unfair to that defendant, in my hypothetical, to say, oh, well, somebody else has been litigating this case for the last 12 months. You can't do this. Assignment may be different. Assignment raises the possibility of arranging your own jurisdiction. But if it had just been somebody out there in the world that you discovered, oops, you know, we should have sued so-and-so too, you know, now we've conducted discovery and there's some other party out there, surely the last defendant rule is proper there.
Yeah, I don't agree that the Supreme Court case would do anything more than merely settle one narrow issue, which was, if you've received a fax copy of a pleading, that doesn't have anything to do with when you must remove. It's when you get served, and then you've got 30 days.
But the court has stressed, I mean, removal is a right of defendants, just as invoking federal jurisdiction to begin with is a right of plaintiffs. And I'm just trying to zero in on how broad the rule is that you're arguing for, whether it's in all cases, all circumstances, or whether it's something unique to the assignment context in all cases where there's assignments, or whether it's something even more particularized to your fact situation.
A few courts have recognized that a brand new defendant can remove based on equitable considerations. There's really no basis in the statute for it. They draw little support from the Supreme Court case because that resolves one very narrow technical issue, which is that the 30 days begins to run from service. The Phoenix Container case, which out of the Northern District, appeal dismissed by this court, was fully aware of that Supreme Court case. I believe it's Murphy Brothers versus Machete Pipe. The Murphy Brothers case does not decide how this case comes out in this court. Moving to the second main issue that I'd like to discuss on oral arguments is what we feel was the court's erroneous conclusion that no reasonable juror could have found that the plaintiff took out her loans for a consumer purpose. That, to me, is a very broad standard which should be liberally applied to keep plaintiffs in court, given these various, very serious allegations and the very obvious conflict in the record. It is distressing to me that the lower court cited a case out of the Tenth Circuit called Tower versus Home Construction Company of Mobile, and it cited it's in an Alabama District Court case. That case was reversed. The main case that they cite to make this finding of a business purpose was reversed by the Tenth Circuit.
But the point is here, I mean, you know, if it's a Tenth Circuit case, it's a Tenth Circuit case, or a District Court case, you know, people, you guys have been citing lots of District Court cases too, and they're not precedential, certainly for us. But the problem that I have here is that your argument seems to rest very heavily on the use to which Ms. Boyd eventually put the proceeds, and that is that's not even a conceivable standard, because lenders need to know at the time the loan is made what legal regime they're under. They need to know whether it's a consumer loan, and thus it's a Truth in Lending Act and various other statutory regime, or they need to know it's a business loan. You can't ask them to say, well, 6 months from now, after we've seen how the person spent the money, now we'll go back and tell you that you did something wrong in your disclosures. It's got to be an ex-ante perspective. And ex-ante, this lady's talking about her investment property.
Your Honor, the main documentation that would have suggested a consumer purpose was the loan application, which said debt consolidation. There was an earlier loan application that said investment, so we have a conflict right there. But fundamentally, what the plaintiff has contended is she was tricked into taking this loan out in the first place.
That's a different issue. What we're talking about is from the bank's point of view. That may be her case against Ms. Orr, for example, or somebody else. But it seems to me that even debt consolidation certainly doesn't preclude the idea of an investment purpose. Maybe she wants to consolidate her investment debt. I don't see that as terribly informative. I think the underlying fact that this property is investment property is a very telling fact about the purpose. And the bank knew that.
the nature of the property being investment should not be determinative of how this issue comes
out. But it's a very important factor. You can't say it's an irrelevant factor.
It's one factor of many which a jury should be permitted to determine. The judge has substituted his decision in this case for an issue which should go to the jury. There are ample facts in this case that would have supported a consumer purpose. Personal income taxes. She got tricked into thinking that if she took out these loans, she wouldn't have to pay these personal income taxes. That's where it begins. This lender, North American Mortgage Company, has to do some investigation to find out what the purpose of that loan.
The lender is supposed to know if she doesn't understand the tax laws?
The lender should make a determination or find out, yes, is it consumer or is it a business loan? They certainly seem to think it was a consumer loan, or they would not have had to issue all these truth in lending disclosure statements. They wouldn't have had her signing uniform residential loan applications.
Well, but we said, you know, we don't want to create a system where lenders are deterred from disclosing because they're afraid they're going to be backed into a corner. Sometimes you disclose more than you have to, just as a routine business practice. It seems wrong to punish them for making a disclosure they didn't have to make.
Your Honor, I would submit that the purpose of the loan was consumer-related at the very beginning, and that her use of the proceeds shows a consumer purpose, and that the last thing...
I don't see how we can take the use of the proceeds into account at all. I really think you need to focus on your evidence up to the point that the loan is made, at the moment when the bank has to decide, what are our legal obligations? What do we need to tell her? What do we need to do?
Well, Your Honor, assuming that this court would determine that it's to look at the transaction as a whole, and the purpose for which the credit was extended, which was the Tenth Circuit test, which is based on the federal regulations, then all of the circumstances should be considered, and not simply the first couple of pieces of paper that would have been involved in that loan transaction. That would make the plaintiff's position very difficult to prove, I think, in most cases, because there's just not that much in those loan applications. It just says debt consolidation. Surely we should put some onus on North American Mortgage Company to realize that this mortgage broker, this Phoenix company, that's all it does is residential loans. It doesn't do any business loans. Their own employees testified to that. It appears to me that this issue should have gone to the jury. I know we're in federal court, but in state court, I got to believe this case would have gone to the jury. Let the jury decide this case. If the jury comes back and says it's a business loan, then we shut our briefcase and that's it. But I submit that the judge should not have submitted his determination for what should have gone to the jury. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. We'll hear now from Mr. Allenworth.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Bruce Allensworth. I represent the Appalachian North American Mortgage Company. As you know, we've divided our time, and I've been asked to speak initially as to the issues of, one, removal, and two, federal preemption, both under the Depository Institutions Monetary Deregulation Control Act and also under the Homeowners Loan Act.
Well, Mr. Allenworth, I can tell you I have a lot of problems with the way this removal occurred, which I think it's very difficult to evaluate this removal on this record, even if we pose the question, do we want a first defendant or a last defendant rule, since the record is completely vague about what people knew, when they knew it, how they were involved in the case, when various parties are assigning to one another, and I'm not even sure we know enough to know whether removal was appropriate.
Well, it seems to me the only way that argument arises is under this collusive removal argument that the appellant raises, for which
right.
they admit they have no evidentiary basis. Perhaps
well, but the burden, as you certainly know, the burden is on the person who's asserting federal jurisdiction to support that assertion, so it's not really their burden to do
it.
Bank One assigned this loan to RFC on September 27, 2001. then, oddly enough, the next day, September 28th, 2001, they file a foreclosure action on the Washington property with respect to a loan that they don't even have anymore because they've assigned it to RFC the day before. Then we have homecoming still involved with a motion to dismiss. Then Boyd is asking to substitute defendants because she learns that Bank One may be the assignee, although there have been other assignments afterwards. I don't see where there are any time limits in the statute if each defendant in a commercial case can just keep assigning on to another defendant and say, oh, you know, here's another 30 days, we just assigned to you. Here's another 30 days, we just assigned to you.
Well, but
how can that be the way Congress intended the time limits in the removal procedure to work?
But it still has to be that, and even your question implies this, that there has to be some collusion. We know.
Why? Why does there even have to be some collusion if there's a time limit for assignment? I mean, sorry, if there's a time limit for removal, why can the defendant's own action manipulate the statute in that way?
But it doesn't manipulate the statute. I mean, what you've got to consider is the underlying cause of action that's involved here. I mean, what happened was North American was brought in because it was the original lender and it had a TILA claim. They then are bringing in these subsequent defendants on a theory of TILA assignee liability, which doesn't even arise until the loan is transferred. So it somehow suggests that defendants would, at least the assignee defendant, would somehow accept TILA liability just for the purpose of creating a basis for federal jurisdiction.
Well, but there guess what? I mean, they didn't even file. Apparently, there are no recorded assignments from this. We don't have documents in the record until the 11th hour or the 13th hour about the actual documentation of the assignment. They may well have taken the assignment, hoping that nobody would notice that they were the assignee.
But the RFC assignment did not. I mean, the foreclosure action and the RFC assignment occurred at or about the same time, and RFC was very quickly brought into this action within a matter of weeks after they even had any potential exposure, which they had none until such time as the loan was assigned to them.
And why did Bank One file a foreclosure action?
There was no way to bring RFC into this case. It had no TILA assignee liability until the loan was assigned to it. Its right, its removal of this case occurred within a month of the time that assignee liability even arose as to it. So why there would be any collusion of a party exposing itself to liability under TILA where no such liability existed?
Well, they have liability under TILA whether or not there's removal, so I'm not sure whether that argument.
They would have no liability until the assignment took place.
Well, that's right, but the assignment's what creates the liability, not the removal.
That's right.
The assignment, so now they're potentially under the TILA assignee liability provisions, whether or not there's removal. So their decision to take the assignment of this loan in the midst of litigation already takes care of the point that you're talking about. Now we're just talking about forum and why it is every defendant gets continual 30-day extensions of time from these assignments.
I think this does go back to Murphy Brothers. Murphy Brothers says the sine qua non of the court even exercising jurisdiction, much less depriving a defendant of procedural rights, is that it actually be subject to and a party that is subject to the jurisdiction of the court. I mean, you're looking at a time sequence here where RFC did not even have any conceivable liability and could not have been made a party to this case prior to September 27, 2001. It is served with the Fourth Amended complaint within less than a month of the time it received the assignment, and it then removed the case less than 3 weeks later. What else could RFC do? If there wouldn't even be a basis for removal based on RFC's liability prior to September 27th because it had none. This case couldn't have been removed by RFC in 2000 or any time up till
But if the rest of the defendants wanted to remove, they changed their mind more than 30 days later, all they have to do is find somebody willing to take the assignment, and they've got the job done.
Well, Judge, there is no evidence, one, in the record that that happened.
Right, and that's my issue. That's why I think we need more evidence about this.
The fact of the matter is it requires the assumption that a party, RSC, entirely unrelated to Bank One as trustee, would knowingly take on TILA liability.
I understand that, but as soon as they took the assignment, they had the potential TILA liability, whether the state court adjudicated it or whether the federal court adjudicated it.
But they didn't take the assignment until September 27th.
I know that, and so that was the decision to become potentially liable, whatever the assessment of the risk was, as a TILA assignee. That's not a decision about
court. But there's no evidence that there was any assessment of the risk and that RFC decided it would make some balancing decision where it would be happy to take assignment of a loan with everything that involved, expose itself to TILA assignee liability, and to be brought into a case in Madison County, Illinois.
But that's where the case was pending in Madison County, Illinois, the day they took the assignment.
Well, I understand, but there's no evidence that RFC was aware of that.
You're kidding.
I don't believe so. It didn't even have
a matter of public record?
I don't know that RFC was looking at the public records to see where all of these loans coming out of a securitization trust as Assinor, as Assinee was taking these loans.
Well,
the point of the matter is, with your permission, I'll keep trying to address your question. I see I'm getting the hook here, but the whole point, I think, again, goes back to Murphy Brothers, entirely a part of this collusive, plan to bring RFC in. I will note that Bank One wasn't even brought into this case until another 6 months later. The plaintiff did no discovery on this issue, no discovery to try and find out what was going on with the loans. The plaintiff had, a year to do that discovery. Never did. If it had done that, it would have known that Bank One was the trustee.
What about this fact that maybe this is incorrect, I don't know. But there's a statement in the record that as of October 11, 2001, a search report of the properties, the subject of this litigation, did not reflect any recorded assignment from North American Mortgage to any other party, including Bank One. So you're saying the plaintiff, notwithstanding the lack of a record in a title search, should have known that Bank One had an interest?
Well, what the case has talked about is that the party, in this case the plaintiff, would do discovery to find out such issues, regardless of whether or not
discovery you order a title search to find out who has an interest in the property.
Well, that's not discovery within the context of the case. I mean, he had the device of discovery available to determine what assignments were, entirely independent of what independent investigation would have revealed. And there
so
was
even
no
though there's no
to
reason
that.
To think there's been an assignment, you think that you should just ask in all loan cases.
I think
have
in
you
discovery,
ever signed
I think
it?
Such discovery would reveal it. But
well,
it doesn't, doesn't
of
again, it doesn't suggest that RFC itself was at all involved in any such collusive discovery, and there's simply no evidence to that effect.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear next from Mr. Antonelli.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. David Antonioli, representing Phoenix Funding Corporation, the loan broker in this transaction. What I intend to discuss, Your Honors, is why the Truth in Lending Act does not apply to this transaction, or for that matter to Phoenix Funding, why the district court was correct in entering summary judgment on the RESPA claims, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, and why there is no Consumer Fraud Act case here. Let me begin with the truth in lending issue. The question is, did the court have a sufficient record to determine the purpose of this loan as a matter of law? The answer is, of course, because the plaintiff admitted what her purpose was. She admitted that she borrowed the money in order to place liens against rental property held for investment purposes so that she could avoid capital gains taxes upon resale of the property. There was a sale pending at the time that she applied for the loans. Counsel for plaintiff points to certain ambiguities in the loan application, but as Judge Reagan noted in his order, the plaintiff resolved those ambiguities with her own testimony. She made it clear what she was borrowing the money for. Under those circumstances, it became a question of law as to whether, under the Truth in Lending Act, this purpose is a consumer purpose or a non-consumer purpose. The court, based on the fact that it's investment property, a tax avoidance scheme, determined, as it had to, that it was a non-consumer purpose. Secondly, with respect to my client, Phoenix Funding Corporation, the Truth in Lending Act does not apply to it because Phoenix was not a creditor in this transaction. The Truth in Lending Act contains a bright line test concerning whether you're a creditor, required to make disclosures, or not. That test is, are you the person to whom the indebtedness is made payable on the face of the instrument? In this case, it was not Phoenix, therefore it is not a creditor, therefore it has no Truth in Lending Act liability. In terms of the real estate settlement procedures claim, Your Honors, since it's not a consumer transaction, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act does not apply. But secondly, there's an independent ground for affirming the court's summary judgment on the Real Estate Settlement Procedures claim, because the undisputed testimony in the record shows that this was a division of fees between two co-brokers who both performed services in the transaction and who testified without dispute that the division was fair in terms of the services they actually performed. That testimony in and of itself precludes the finding of kickback, which was the theory of plaintiff's case here, unless the plaintiff can come up with some evidence to rebut it. The plaintiff didn't, therefore summary judgment was proper. Lastly, with respect to the Consumer Fraud Act, Your Honors, it is important to note on this record that the plaintiff affirmatively disclaimed that my client, Phoenix Funding, or any of the banking institutions involved made any representations to her at all, let alone misrepresentations.
I take it nobody is here today representing Ms. Orr. Is that right? Is she out there back in the state court? What's her status?
She is still subject to liability in the state court under the negligent misrepresentation count, Your Honor, which is really what this case ought to be. The plaintiff's beef here is that somebody conned her, i.e. Ms. Orr, conned her into taking this loan. It's a business transaction. She shouldn't have this case brought under the rubric of the consumer laws. Thank you, Your Honors, and I appreciate the court's attention, and I hope that the court will affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Agnoli. We'll hear next from Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Your Honors. I understand that I have 5 minutes. I'd like to cede 4 of my minutes to Mr. Allensworth, given that he didn't reach a lot of the important preemption issues that he wanted to reach. I am counsel for RFC Bank One as trustee. The points that I would like to make are that we seek affirmance, 5 points really, seek affirmance on the matter of the non-applicability of PILA to this as a commercial transaction. On the rescission claims, PILA very carefully circumscribes when you have acne liability under PILA. That doesn't apply here because this is not an owner-occupied property. Even if it were not a commercial property, it's still not an owner-occupied property. It doesn't give rise to PILA rescission rights. plaintiff is trying to come in through the back door of a common law rescission claim when, in fact, Tillich carefully says you have no rescission right unless it's owner-occupied. So those claims ought to be gone as well. With respect to the other truth in lending claims, even if truth in lending did apply here, if it weren't an investment business property, those, I believe, are really kind of red herrings here. We've gone into these at length in our brief, and I'd also have the court take a look at our reply with respect to summary judgment in the district court that runs through a lot of these. We didn't have a reply here in the appellate court, but I'd have the court take a look at those. The itemization of the amount financed is a non-issue here. You can use the HUD 1 statement for that. With respect to the early truth in lending disclosures, those simply don't apply because this property was not for the acquisition or initial construction of the consumer's dwelling. Therefore, the truth in lending requirement of early TILA disclosures doesn't engage. With respect to the variable rate disclosures that plaintiff is complaining about, those were, at least as to my client's assignees, we were able to rely on the documentation that plaintiff attaches to his own complaint that indicates that the variable rate disclosures were given. With respect to the special information booklet matters which plaintiff raises, those are RESPA matters. Those aren't truth in lending matters. They are not ones that support a private right of action anyway, even under RESPA. I'd also have the court, for my clients, extend the rationale of the court's ruling with respect to the consumer commercial purpose of the loan to the affirmative defenses in the foreclosure case. I understand that the court indicated it didn't have the foreclosure complaints or answers in the file. Nevertheless, once those were provided and the court requested that they be provided, if one takes a look at those answers and counter affirmative defenses of foreclosure cases, it is absolutely utterly unmistakable that they are essentially word for word the same as the affirmative truth in lending claims in the primary affirmative suit. Since we've had 6 amended complaints already and years of litigation already on this matter, it seems to be an utter judicial waste to have this go back to the state court and not have the logic of the trial court's ruling with respect to truth in lending extend to the affirmative defenses in the foreclosure case.
You're not confident the state court would see it your way down?
Well, I'm confident they would, but I think, frankly, with the time that's been invested in this so far, it's really just a waste of judicial resources not to do that now.
What jurisdiction does the district court have over a case after it's been remanded?
Well, I believe that here all the matters that are properly reviewable in this court, and I believe the matter of the non-extension of this to the affirmative defenses is reviewable. If anything else here is reviewable, and plaintiff certainly believes things here are reviewable, the termination of the case in the district court, I believe that those matters can be reviewed here, and the court's conclusion here on the extension of this to the affirmative defenses, the court could make a pronouncement on that, and I assume it would have preclusive effect as law of the case, and preclude that claim being able to be pursued or raised as an affirmative defense, notwithstanding that the case in chief is back in the trial court. I assume that happens many times when there's kind of a piecemeal federal claim that gets appealed and the balance of the case gets remanded.
Well, what we decide is the federal part that's here. We don't decide things about state parts that went back to state.
But this is a federal issue. I mean,
we understand, you know, counts 1, 2, and 3 come up on appeal to this court, we decide counts 1, 2, and 3. If counts 4 and 5 went back to the state court, we don't interfere with the state court.
But this matter was the subject of a proper Rule 59 motion before the time that the court remanded
the case back. Was the actual file still in the district court?
Well, the actual, it's interesting, the court's order that officially remanded the case dated March 19, 2001 wasn't mailed by the court until March 21st. It's Exhibit E to our reply with respect to our Rule 59 motion in the trial court. So it wasn't even mailed until the day that we'd already filed the Rule 59 motion with respect to the March 10th order. So you can't hardly say that there was something improper about or that the court had divested itself of jurisdiction when at the point in time we filed the Rule 59 motion, the court hadn't even yet mailed the ruling that remands it to the trial court. Your Honor, I think I've used more than my time, and I really wanted to cede this to Mr. Allensworth. He's got some important points.
I'm afraid that your side has used its time.
Okay, thank you.
How much time does Mr. Hamilton has? 3 minutes?
3 minutes? I'll address 4 points. Phoenix is a creditor. There was an obligation payable initially to them, and that's this 10% fee that we've been complaining of. Now, if the obligation must be payable simply to the note holder and no one else, then the judge was correct, but I don't think they were. Phoenix made representations about being the creditor in this case, and it's unquestionable that they got this 10% fee. That was an obligation payable to them. But Phoenix would have it both ways. They would say, we're not a creditor under Truth in Lending, but we should be protected as a creditor under the BIDMCA. They can't have it both ways. They can't both have insulation from Truth in Lending and have insulation under the Illinois Interest Act. As far as the question under RESPA as to the split, I believe that Phoenix is clearly incorrect. The whole purpose of that HUD 1 is to disclose exactly who's getting the money. If there's going to be a 10% loan origination fee and half of it's going to go to some other broker, I submit that's got to be on there. And if they don't do it, that's an illegal kickback and it's prohibited by federal law. As to Residential Funding Corporation and Bank One, they would have this court go through the very technical issues raised by the Truth in Lending without the benefit of the district court having even really gotten to those points. And without the jury having an opportunity to consider those points, I would suggest the court should not do that. And then finally, the issue that they appeal raised about their foreclosure complaints and the affirmative defense, when the court denied their motion for summary judgment, that's not a final order for any purposes in any court. This court should dismiss that portion of their appeal. This court has no jurisdiction to consider whether those affirmative defenses, whether the court's holding in the district court should be extended to those affirmative defenses. And I've completed my argument. Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel in this case, and the case will be taken under advisement.